From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. You can see Lenny Pickett every week playing tenor saxophone in the Saturday Night Live band. Today on Fresh Air, Lenny Pickett joins us with his own band, the Borneo Horns, for a live concert. Also today, poet Michael Ryan reads from his latest collection, God Hunger. Rock historian Ed Ward looks back at the career of Norman the General Johnson. And some thoughts about high-class enunciation from linguist Jeffrey Nunberg. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. Soviet lawmakers today refused to consider stripping the Communist Party of its constitutional guarantee of power. President Mikhail Gorbachev led the opposition to the release of power by communists, but he gave his clearest signal to date of a willingness to consider removing the party's supremacy as part of a constitutional overhaul expected next year. Secretary of State James Baker is in Berlin today, where he called for more cooperation in Europe to manage the changes that are sweeping the continent. Baker also is planning a short visit to Potsdam in East Germany to meet with East German Prime Minister Hans Mudrow. NPR's Mike Schuster reports from Berlin.
Baker was thinking about going to East Germany for more than a week, but only decided last night when he came to Berlin for a one-day visit to make the trip. Today he met for 1 hour with East German Prime Minister Hans Mudrow. Baker said he had come to show U.S. support for the process of reform now underway in East Germany. According to officials present, Mudrow told Baker that the reforms are irreversible and that he personally is committed to holding free elections in East Germany in May. Baker also met with leaders of the East German Lutheran Church, which has been active in the opposition. They told him Mudrow is a man committed to peaceful change in East Germany. I'm Mike Schuster in West Berlin.
The White House said today it is skeptical of a peace plan worked out today by five Central American presidents. Spokesman Marlon Fitzwater said the administration has doubts about a portion of the plan that calls for using American aid to Nicaraguan rebels to disband and repatriate the Contras. El Salvador's leftist guerrillas have reacted angrily to that same peace plan, Tom Gibb reports.
The rebel high command say they reject the declaration with indignation. The five presidents signed an accord in the early hours of this morning which condemns armed action and terrorism by irregular forces in the region. It also calls for the rebels to stop all actions affecting civilians and return to dialogue with the government. The rebel communique criticized the accord, saying it gave unconditional support to a government which is the worst human rights violator in the region. The rebels warn that the results of the summit will only deepen the crisis in El Salvador. Last month, they mounted their biggest offensive of the 10-year-old civil war. They want a recognition that they control territory and a purge of the armed forces as part of any ceasefire deal. For National Public Radio, this is Tom Gibb in San Salvador.
The National AIDS Commission, backed by some three dozen national organizations, today urged the Bush administration to drop its policy restricting entry into the United States of people infected with AIDS. Current rules that prohibit visas for individuals carrying the AIDS virus have prompted a wave of protest because of the limits it will place on the 6th International AIDS Conference. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose more than 24 points to close at 2752. This is NPR News. There's been another skirmish in what may become a fishing war between the U.S. and Canada. American officials today questioned the captain and crew of a Massachusetts fishing boat about warning shots a Canadian naval vessel fired at them yesterday. This summer, there have been at least two similar incidents. Steve Kerwood of member station WBUR in Boston reports.
National Marine Fisheries Service and U.S. Coast Guard officials today boarded the Massachusetts scalloper Concordia after the 114-foot boat tangled yesterday with a Canadian naval destroyer. The Canadians claimed the U.S. vessel was 2.5 miles inside Canadian waters fishing for scallops. When the Canadians tried to halt the American boat, the two craft collided, and the Canadians then fired a number of warning shots from a machine gun. Coast Guard officials said they met the Concordia at the edge of U.S. territorial waters and escorted her back to New Bedford, where they boarded the ship and questioned her crew. Concordia's captain says his charts indicate he wasn't fishing in foreign waters. If U.S. officials find the boat was fishing illegally, she could be subject to a $20,000 fine per incident. In Boston, for National Public Radio, I'm Steve Curwood.
The White House said today the Bush administration may lift bans on normal commercial exports to China, including satellites. Spokesman Marlon Fitzwater said President Bush is reviewing sanctions imposed after the violent crackdown on pro-democracy demonstrators. Specifically, the administration is looking at three Hughes aircraft communication satellites, one due for launch by China in April, the others in 1991 and 92, that were held up by Bush's ban on the export of weapons and satellites to China last June. The Defense Department today refused to confirm or deny an American company's claim that it received Pentagon approval to export personal computer parts to the Soviet Union. Innovation International announced yesterday it had jumped the defense hurdle and needed only final approval from the Commerce Department for the deal after being rejected several times previously by the Pentagon. I'm Frank Stasio, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. You've probably heard Lenny Pickett in the Saturday Night Live band. In fact, he's the one who takes the tenor solo on the theme. Lenny Pickett is with me for a live concert with his saxophone trio, the Borneo Horns. The group features Stan Harrison on alto, Steve Elson on baritone, and Lenny Pickett on tenor. They met in 1983 when they were in the horn section of David Bowie's World Concert Tour. They've each played in diverse settings. Lenny Pickett spent several years with the funk band Tower of Power. He's played on records by dozens of performers, including the Beach Boys, the Bee Gees, Talking Heads, Paul McCartney, and Grace Jones. Steve Elson grew up with Lenny. When he was still a teenager, he played with Johnny Otis's rhythm and blues band. He just got off the Joe Jackson tour and also recently received an NEA Composer's Grant. Stan Harrison has played with Southside Johnny and Diana Ross, and for the last few years, he's played with Duran Duran. Together, my guests are the Borneo Horns. They have a record called Lenny Pickett with the Borneo Horns on Carthage Records. Welcome to Fresh Air. Lenny, let me ask you before you play the first piece, how you compose for horns, like how you're using the horns in your compositions.
I think about them as being independent voices, and I write them largely contrapuntally. That is, they play independent parts, which is a little dissimilar to the way they use horns in big band settings or in rock and roll horn sections, where there's a minimum of that and a lot of homophonic playing, where everybody plays the same line. I try and write more polyphonically.
You also have to have the horns carry both the melody and the rhythm.
Well, rhythm and melody are much intertwined, and so I think of it as being several melodies sounding simultaneously, which has the elements of rhythm within the melodies.
Well, why don't you play the first piece for us?
Okay, this is Dance Music for Borneo Horns number 8, and most of you have never heard this before.
Thank you. That's the Borneo Horns playing live on Fresh Air. And the Borneo Horns are Lenny Pickett on tenor, Steve Elson on baritone, Stan Harrison on alto. Now, the three of you met when you were playing in the horn section of the David Bowie 1983 World Tour. Was this a way to, getting together was a way to get out, to do something other than the parts that you were playing on the tour?
Well, we had a lot of time on our hands.
Uh-huh.
When you do a rock tour, you usually do two or three concerts a week, and they only take 2 hours, and the sound check maybe another couple of hours. So let's see, there's 7 times 24 minus 12, and the rest of the time you have to sleep part of it and do something else. So I would stay in my room and write music when I got tired of wandering around shopping malls and you know, wrote things for us to play, and we'd play them in the sound checks while they weren't using us, which was most of the time. And that's the way it goes.
Let me ask you, you've all played with a lot of different rock bands and rhythm and blues bands, as well as with the Borneo Horns. When the people from the rock bands hear what you're playing with this group, do they like it? I mean, do they have an ear for that?
Yeah, I think they think it's different. I mean, this is not the usual configuration.
Yeah,
you know, we're
yeah.
three saxophone players, and I think they're generally surprised that we get as big a sound as we do.
Mm-hmm.
But it's different than they're used to.
Can I ask you, just for contrast, to play a line like you'd play if you were with David Bowie when you met back in 83?
What do you want to do?
Let's Dance.
It's only been, what, 6 years?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah. 2, 4.
You can't stop them, you know.
So did you have movements and everything playing together in the section?
Oh, yes. We had dance movements and everything. We were great. let's see. They spoke highly of us. The reviewers loved us. Oh, we had a whole collection of reviews. They were fantastic.
Well, I'll tell you what. Let's take a short break, and then we'll come back some more and continue the concert with the Borneo Horns. And this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
We're featuring a live concert with the Borneo Horns. And the Borneo Horns feature Lenny Pickett on tenor, Steve Elson on baritone, and Stan Harrison on alto. And Lenny, let me ask you to introduce the next composition. I should say all these compositions today are written by Lenny Pickett.
Right. This one is called A Nice Yellow Room, and it sort of reminds me of a colorful motel on the beach in Miami that an elderly Jewish couple lives in. And this is sort of the internal part of that particular locale.
great piece. Let me ask you, you're playing a very small clarinet.
Mm-hmm.
No, it's a regular size clarinet. Mm-hmm. No, it's a small Mm-mm. clarinet.
It's the small clarinet.
Yeah. Tell me about the technique you were using playing that.
It's called slap tonguing.
Mm-hmm.
And this is called the small clarinet. The official name is small clarinet. It appears in all the Stravinsky scores as the small clarinet.
So, anyways, it's a neat sound you get out of it.
Thank you. With that slap sort tonguing. Of primitive-esque.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Very modern, sort of technically advanced instrument, born in the 19th century Industrial Revolution, and I've modified it for a pre-Columbian sound.
Let me ask you, Lenny, I think some of our listeners will probably be interested in the Saturday Night Live band, what goes on there behind the scenes. What are you playing that we don't get to hear when we're watching on TV?
We play all kinds of music. It's our policy and our motto is all kinds of music played here. And we play everything from klezmer music to we have an African piece out of a sort of a African high life band. Thing that we found someplace. GE found it and doesn't know who wrote it, but we do just about anything. We do a lot of old jazz things and modern rock and roll, a lot of blues. We're a blues band primarily, but we play all. We play Ina Klein and Nacht music also.
You're in the position of having to improvise on that theme every week.
Yes.
Do you get tired of it?
No, I love it.
Okay. We have another composition going up, and we're featuring a live concert with the Borneo Horns, and Lenny Pickett, who is just speaking, composed all the music that we're hearing today. He's also the tenor player in the Saturday Night Live band, and also performing with him, we have Steve Elson on baritone and Stan Harrison on alto, and the three of them met when they were playing in 1983 in the David Bowie horn section on his world tour. Lenny, let me ask you to introduce the next composition.
This is dance music. For Borneo Horns number 4. I wrote this after a particularly grueling season at the circus in Manhattan, where I played up on an 18-foot platform. I had to play 3 different instruments and climb up there, play them in a terribly hot tent in the middle of the winter with elephants underneath. And I came home one evening. All my relatives were asleep. They had visited me. It was Christmas time. And they were all sick, and all the shades were drawn. I went in my studio and I wrote this. Thank you.
Sorry to have to end the concert before the piece ends, but it looks like we're just out of time. We've been listening to a concert with the Borneo Horns. That's Lenny Pickett, Steve Elson, and Stan Harrison. They have an album on Carthage Records called Lenny Pickett and the Borneo Horns. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, our guest will be the Welsh explorer and writer Tristan Jones. I hope you can join us. We leave you with a few bars from the album Lenny Pickett and the Borneo Horns.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. In the words of one critic, Michael Ryan's latest collection of poems, God Hunger, has an aesthetic honesty that both startles and satisfies. Ryan's earlier books earned him a Guggenheim Fellowship and a nomination for the National Book Award. Coming up, Michael Ryan reads from God Hunger. Also, rock historian Ed Ward profiles Norman Johnson. He was part of the 70s group, the chairman of the board, but how Johnson ended up there is quite a story. And we hear from Jeffrey Nunberg, a linguist who isn't going to get on your case to enunciate. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Five Central American presidents ended their conference in Costa Rica today by endorsing a peace agreement. The Latin American leaders gave their support to the government of El Salvador, which is fighting leftist rebels, but the rebel forces say that they are turning down the peace accord. The presidents also expressed backing for President Ortega of Nicaragua in his bid to end U.S. support for the Contras. A major opinion poll in Chile is showing that presidential elections being held there Thursday may lead to a runoff election. As David Wellner reports from Santiago, a second round of voting would greatly increase the chances of a right-wing candidate winning the presidency.
Results released from the latest Gallup Chile poll indicate there's a possibility that none of the three presidential candidates will win the necessary majority on Thursday, forcing a runoff election. Up to now, the polls have showed slightly more than a majority supporting the candidate of the Chilean opposition, Christian Democrat Patricio Elwin. But the Gallup survey predicts Elwin may fall just short of the 50% mark in voting Thursday. If this were to happen, Elwin would probably have to face off with Hernán Bichi, the former finance minister of Chilean dictator General Augusto Pinochet. Although Bichi is expected to get less than a third of the votes this time, he would likely do much better in a second round, picking up the votes of third-ranked Francisco Errázuriz, another right-wing candidate. For National Public Radio, I'm David Wellner in Santiago.
In Mexico, a district court judge has handed down a verdict in the 1984 murder of drug enforcement agent Enrique Camarena. A convicted drug trafficker was found guilty in the case and has been sentenced to a total of 115 years in prison. Lucy Conger reports from Mexico City.
Two of Mexico's notorious drug traffickers, Rafael Caro Quintero and Ernesto Rafael Fonseca, were found guilty of premeditated homicide in the murder case. The two drug lords had operated out of the northern city of Guadalajara, and in their heyday helped make that city Mexico's leading drug center. Under a previous administration, Mexico acted slowly in the case, and the murder of the DEA agent often provoked strains in relations between Mexico and the United States. Several months ago, drug lord Caro Quintero made news here because he was living in the lap of luxury in his jail cell. As a result, top prison officials were fired, and Caro Quintero will now serve his long sentence in an austere prison cell. For National Public Radio, I'm Lucy Conger in Mexico City.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrials closed up almost 24 points to close at 2,752.13 on volume of some 176 million shares. Trading was active as advancing issues led declines by 3-2. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Well, this isn't a comeback story on the scale of Tina Turner. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward has the story of the comeback of General Johnson.
Rock, roll, rock, roll.
The guy who wrote that there were no second acts in American lives never met General Johnson. Here's someone who managed a nearly impossible feat in the fast-changing world of popular music, reviving his career several times without making it look like a comeback. Now, Norman Johnson wasn't really a general. That was just what the guys he sang with called him, because he was such a natural leader. Probably this was due to his extensive experience. He made his first recording at the age of 11 as a member of a group called the Humdingers, and he was already a veteran of several gospel groups by then. The Humdingers were the hottest thing going in Norfolk, Virginia, but they didn't really get a break until 1961 when Joe Banaschak at Minute Records in New Orleans sent his talent scout, Alan Toussaint, up to Virginia to listen to them. He liked what he heard, and the first time they stepped into the studio, they cut a song due to be a classic.
You take some music, music, free-flowing music, some moving and grooving, rock and roll stands, take some hot beats, drums, beats.
It Will Stand was only a moderate hit at the time, but the group, which had been rechristened The Showmen, was hot. People loved the sort of strangled sound the general got out of his voice, and the way they had the gospel intensity the Isley Brothers got in their act.
When I left home and came to town, I thought I was the biggest port around. I wore a pinchback suit and button shoes. The city boys called me a country dude. When I got to town, everything had changed. Everybody looking at me so strange. A horse boy and a big beat, a dog barking at the mouth.
But Minute apparently had trouble promoting any act that wasn't New Orleans-based, and the Showmen eventually faded away. Johnson, though, had had a taste of fame and wasn't about to give up. He'd become friends with Lamont Dozier of Motown's famed writing and production team Holland, Dozier & Holland, and when they split with Motown over money and started their own Invictus label, they needed talent. Johnson had been writing material, and Dozier invited him to check out some of the people who were auditioning for Invictus. Soon, Johnson was singing with Danny Woods from Atlanta, Eddie Curtis from Philadelphia, and Harrison Kennedy, who was Canadian. They called themselves the Chairman of the Board. Naturally, with the team that had been behind the Supremes' run of number one records producing them, the Chairmen hit with their very first single.
Give me just a little more time, just a little more time. And I'll surely grow. Give me just a little more time. Give me just a little more time, just a little more time. And I'll surely grow. Just a little more time. Life's too short to make a mistake. Let's think of each other and hesitate.
Their next one, though, could have been right out of the vaults of classic Motown.
You got me dangling on a string. Please don't let me drop. My life was surely stopped. Cause I'm wrapped in a dream of needing you so. My heart's in a noose and I can't break loose. I'm not handsome man that I used to be. And I admit it, you live.
And after a dated little hippie ditty called Everything's Tuesday that didn't do too well, the Chairmen finished up their incredible run of 1970 hits with one that managed to include nearly every important influence on the contemporary soul scene without managing to sound forced. And as if the year wasn't lucky enough for the General, the B-side of Everything's Tuesday contained a song that, although everybody ignored the original version, was one of those sentimental numbers that people have recorded over and over again.
I was born and raised down in Alabama on a farm way back up in the woods. I was so ragged folks called me Patches. Papa used to tease me about it, but inside he was hurting because he'd done all he could. My papa, what a great old man! I can see him with a shovel in his hand. See, education daddy never had, but he did wonders when the times got bad. But
Patches was a hit for soul singer Clarence Carter and many others in the years to come. Late in 1971, the Chairman of the Board began to break up. Solo albums by the individual members appeared, and finally the whole thing collapsed. General Johnson went on to write songs for other artists, and recently he's been spotted performing with Danny Woods as the Chairman. Maybe Act Three is about to begin.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, the Rolling Stone history of rock and roll. He also writes for the Austin Chronicle. This is Fresh Air. In 1973, Michael Ryan was chosen by the poet Stanley Kunitz to receive the Yale Series of Younger Poets Award. Kunitz has said Ryan writes intense, desperate poems. Ryan's new book of poems, his third, is called God Hunger. He's won the Texas Institute of Letters Prize, a Whiting Writers Award, and was nominated for a National Book Award in 1974. Ryan's poems and essays have been published in the American Poetry Review, The Atlantic, The Nation, and The New Yorker. I asked Ryan to read the poem Milk the Mouse from his new collection. The title comes from a child's game.
The game is taking the child's pinky, little finger on his hand, and squeezing it between the father's thumb and finger, and the game is how long can he stand it before he kneels down and screams for him to stop.
This is a game your father played with you?
Yeah,
alone?
It is.
And you hated it?
Oh, of course. This is called Milk the Mouse. It's a villanelle. He'll pinch my pinky until the mouse starts squeaking. The floor lamp casts a halo around his big stuffed chair. Be strong, be tough. It is my father speaking. I'm 4 or 5. Was he already drinking? With its tip and knuckle between his thumb and finger, he'll pinch my pinky until the mouse starts squeaking. Stop, Daddy, stop. It was more like screeching. And kneels down before him on the hardwood floor. Be strong, be tough. It is my father speaking. What happened to him that he'd do such a thing? It's only a game. He's doing me a favor to pinch my pinky until the mouse starts squeaking, because the world will run over a weakling, and we must crush the mouse or be crushed later. Be strong, be tough. It was my father speaking to himself, of course, to the child inside him aching, not to me. But how can I not go when he calls me over to pinch my pinky until the mouse starts squeaking? Be strong, be tough. It is my father speaking.
Did you ever feel on not getting that kind of strong, tough surface that you were letting your father down?
Sure, absolutely. Absolutely. And that's the power of it, because love is always fused with hate, you know, or hate with love. I mean, it's especially in a parental, I think, situation. And the power of anything like this sort of way of treating a child is because the child loves the parent, loves him. And so it has great force. And rejecting that means, in a sense, to reject him, or he certainly would have made me feel that way.
Did you write poems about your father when he was still alive and capable of reading them?
No, he wasn't. I didn't start writing poems until the year after he died. He died when I was 18.
Oh, so you didn't write any poems at all?
No,
until
after he died? Not a one.
Is that related?
Maybe. I think probably it is. But I also went away to college. I grew up in Allentown, PA, and was a jock and no boy in my high school who wanted to maintain his masculinity, quote-unquote, would have dared to write poems.
You've written several essays about the social role of poetry now and how poetry seems to have really lost its audience, in part because it's become difficult and inaccessible. You say some poets write as if they want to be interpreted, not read.
Yeah, exactly.
So how would you like to see your poems function?
I'd like to see, have them be heard.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think that the poem is an aural, A-U-R-A-L, experience, as well as an oral experience, O-R-A-L. I don't think it exists even on the page, even being read. I think it has to be said out loud and felt out loud, much less be a text, quote-unquote, to be interpreted. To me, the vitality of poetry is in the physicality of saying it and hearing it.
Well, one of the subjects that you write about again and again is death, suicide, fear of death, being left by someone who is dead.
Yeah.
There's a poem that's related to that that I want you to read,
okay.
And it's called First Exercise.
Okay. First Exercise. I was swimming because I wanted to get skinny, having passed the age of 30 when the body begins its gradual revenge for all those days of inattention it secretly begrudged all along. So I was finally paying it my full attention, pulling it as I could back and forth across the pool's width at the baby end, standing after each lap to wait for breath and study the excellent rhythms of the swimmers in the roped lanes of the Olympic pool adjoining, as the light through high leaded windows broke into diamonds off their wakes. Nodding in turn to my companions at this end, two impossibly vigorous, white-capped old men and a dark woman in a black spandex suit that fit her like skin. I've always hated swimming for impeccable reasons, especially since I'm nearly blind without my contact lenses, and I didn't understand the new goggles I bought for my new regimen did not mean I could keep my lenses in and see new things. So from one of my fancy underwater racing turns, I came up without them and touched my eyes and looked and felt a rush of panic into my chest, the shock when someone says there's been a terrible accident and you don't know who or what. Of course, after a second, I thought, it's only your contact lenses. But I dived for them anyway, again and again, trying to hold myself under to pet the tile with my palms. And later, as I walked home, the world a blur of dull color run together, I thought of my friend diving at dusk in that mountain lake for his daughter, and what came to him when his hands sank into the cold mud at the bottom.
Are you ever afraid of giving yourself over to certain feelings that you're expressing in a poem because they're dangerous feelings?
I don't know what you mean by giving yourself over.
To too much loneliness or too much thought about death or those who have died.
That the poem itself would be a threat to that? It's actually the opposite. Yeats has a wonderful line in a wonderful poem called Lapis Lazuli. He says, gaiety transfiguring all that dread. And what he means by that is the gaiety of making. So that, in fact, the poem, I hope it's more than this, but poems are, for me, ways of making, I hope, something beautiful out of something difficult. And not always things difficult. Maybe I am overemphasizing too much that poems can come out of other emotions besides desperate ones. But there is something inherent. Philip Larkin, a poem, a poet I love, says, happiness writes white. There is a way in which the urgency of personal emotion maybe has to, that the inherent tension in a poem needs to be between that joy of making and the contrary emotion which causes it, which makes it necessary.
There's a poem in which you describe how a bird flies into your cold wood-burning stove and gets terribly injured, and you go back, realizing that there's not much you can do. You go back to your work and you say, I tried to clear it from my mind and return to the work I had waiting. That is most of what I can do, even if it changes nothing.
Yeah.
Is that basically the way you feel about writing? Like, you're not going to change the world by doing it, but it's what you can do, so you might as well just accept it and do what you do and not try to do what it is that you don't do or can't do.
Right. That's absolutely the way I feel about it. And in addition to that, I feel that poetry is one of the few things in our culture that can tell the truth, because it's economically worthless or almost worthless, and it doesn't need corporate sponsorship and to please corporate ideology in order to exist, the way in which movies and television and even radio needs to. So that it's just one person saying what it is for him or her to be alive.
Michael Ryan, thank you very much for talking with us.
You're welcome. It was my pleasure.
Michael Ryan's new collection of poems is called God Hunger. It's published by Viking. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Terry. Lots of news tonight. Secretary of State James Baker is meeting in Potsdam, East Germany, with Premier Hans Modrow. Britain decides, after much criticism, to suspend the forced repatriation of Vietnamese aliens. 51 were taken back to Hanoi on an early morning flight. The United States criticized the action, as did Amnesty International. Also, a report on the lobbying power of the National Rifle Association, and another story about a death by firearms. 21-year-old victim in San Antonio, Texas, shot through the heart. Most likely it was a drug-related killing.
Thanks, Noah. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Your parents may have nagged you to speak correctly. Your teachers may have drilled you on making your O's rounder. But linguist Jeffrey Nunberg says you can relax.
One of the most engaging books about language in the past year was Robert McNeil's Wordstruck. It's a memoir about the beginnings of McNeil's infatuation with the English language when he was growing up in the 30s and 40s on Nova Scotia as the son of shabby, genteel parents with a bookish bent. One poignant recollection involved McNeil's mother's insistence that her children speak with clear diction. He tells it this way. Enunciate your vowels, she was always saying, enunciate your vowels, in the way her father, Dr. Oxner, the dentist, said, masticate your food, and his wife, Daisy Oxner, would ask dramatically, have you moved your bowels? These admonitions all took on the same moral coloring to me and played like mantras through my early years. Have you moved your bowels, masticate your food, enunciate your vowels? I read this and thought, oh yeah, that's my father to a T. Not that my father had a lot else in common with a Halifax schoolteacher. He was a New York businessman, the son of immigrants. But like McNeil's mother, he clung to diction like a raft that would keep him afloat above the plebeian tide. The only difference was that McNeil was a more dutiful son than I. He wound up with diction crisp as Canadian bacon, whereas I was a rebellious child and became a chronic mumbler, condemned to go through life with, I beg your pardon, and how's that again, trailing in my wake. Not long ago, at the urging of Ed Koch, the New York City schools announced a program aimed at eradicating the slovenly speech habits of the city's pupils. Posters would be hung in the schools identifying 20 common speech demons, as they were called, things like, I'll meet you at the corner, rather than I'll meet you at the corner. Now, given the scope of the problems in the New York City schools, this might strike you as a low-priority concern, all the more since this particular enterprise is sublimely futile. Even so, diction has always been a cardinal virtue in the psyche of the North American middle class. Enunciation may not be next to godliness, but it's close. From dropping syllables, it seems only a short step to bad personal habits, incivility, even doubtful political opinions. Just after the First World War, hundreds of thousands of schoolchildren were made to recite a linguistic pledge of allegiance promulgated by a group called the American Speech Committee. It began, I love the United States of America. I love my country's flag. I love my country's language. I promise that I will not dishonor my country's speech by leaving off the last syllable of words, that I will say a good American yes and no in place of an Indian grunt, uh-huh, or a foreign ya or yeah or nope, that I will do my best to improve American speech by avoiding loud, rough tones, by enunciating distinctly, and by speaking pleasantly, clearly, and sincerely. To see the irony of all this, you don't even have to change the channel. Just leave the set on PBS after the McNeil-Lehrer report goes off and wait for William F. Buckley's firing line. Buckley's upper-class accent shows nothing but disdain for middle-class fastidiousness about enunciation. It has different names in different cities. In Philadelphia, it's sometimes called the mainline malocclusion. In New York, it's Locust Valley lockjaw. But the basic accent is the same throughout the East, the clenched teeth drawl you can hear from Buckley or George Plimpton, the accent that Jim Backus parodied on Gilligan's Island. When working-class children slur their speech that way, it's taken as a sign of laziness, or worse. But in the mouths of upper-class children, it means something else. It shows that they've learned the important lesson that whatever one does, one mustn't sound as if one were trying too hard.
Jeffrey Nunberg is a linguist associated with the Institute for Research on Learning in Palo Alto, California. Our reviews and commentaries are produced by Naomi Person, with assistance from Joan Tui and Roberta Shorrock. Joyce Lieberman is our technical director. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we meet sailor, adventurer, and author Tristan Jones. He sailed more miles than anyone alive, through every imaginable hardship, and amazingly, lived to tell the tale. And we'll hear from Kay Fassett, an artist who gave up painting for knitting. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join me for the next Fresh Air.